right now, man could destroy the planet, could actually take the power of gods and destroy everything.
Now, Arjuna's crisis is that if he doesn't defect from the fight and wins, he's going to slaughter millions of his cousins, his teachers, his grandfather. He's like, I can't fight this war because I can't conceive of a righteous war where you kill your own family.
There's this other book called Njal's Saga, which is an Icelandic book, which it starts with like some sheep grazing on the wrong side of someone's property and ends with like the total destruction of the legal moral order of Iceland.
Right. Earlier in the text, Krishna tells Arjuna, look, if you choose not to act, it's still a choice and it has consequences. So there's no way to be in the world in a vacuum and not affect it.
Robert Oppenheimer said what is possibly the most metal phrase in all of science. He said, I am become death, destroyer of worlds. So on July 16th, 1945, the father of the atomic bomb was in New Mexico looking out at the Trinity test site where this enormous machine was suspended about 100, 150 feet above the desert and was about to go off. At about 5 a.m, well, it did. And this ushered us into the nuclear age. This blast rocketed right across, the deserts. They were wearing sunscreen. He was looking through like this tinted glass, and they had no clue exactly how powerful this was going to be. And then Robert Oppenheimer said what is possibly the most metal phrase in all of science. He said, I am become death, destroyer of worlds, which is a really freaking crazy statement. If you know, it comes from the ancient Hindu text, the Bhagavad Gita. And you know, for people who are listening to this, you probably know that there is a movie about Robert Oppenheimer where this quote plays an enormous role. It's probably become the most famous quote from the Bhagavad Gita that has circulated in the world, because it was repeated at the moment where we almost destroyed the planet, where we ushered in this new, I mean, almost ethic, the world that I have grown up in, that you probably have grown up in. It fundamentally changed reality, because right now, man could destroy the planet, could actually take the power of gods and destroy everything. And when we look at the Oppenheimer movie, and when the trailer says, I am become death, destroyer of worlds, it just sort of sounds like it's just a badass thing to say. And when I was thinking about the quote, and I realized that there was some sort of like weird grammar going on, right? It says, I am become death. Like, that's not English. Like, what why would it be become death? And I realized that it was a proper noun, that become death was a capital B, capital D. It's the name of a being. I am become death. That is my name. And I wanted to explore this question more. Like, why did Oppenheimer say it? It wasn't just because it was metal. Oppenheimer was actually a really interesting guy with a deep understanding of Sanskrit, deep learning in the Bhagavad Gita. And he was in a really difficult spot, right? Because we were in World War II. And if he didn't develop the bomb, the Germans would, or the Russians would. And he had to make this choice. Is it really worth it for me to do this? I mean, the guy was a socialist. The guy wasn't on the side of the US other than the fact that he had to fight on the side of the US. He had a duty to do it. And you know, the movie Oppenheimer really gets into this stuff. And for me to talk about the Bhagavad Gita and understand it, well, I read it back in college, and then I just picked it up again. I have this like really tiny version. It's called the Bhagavad Gita Song of God, because Bhagavad Gita means Song of God. My version's about, you know, 180 pages long. And I read it in like a couple hours. It's a super easy thing, really interesting concepts of like morality and duty that I was going to get into. But I also want to tell you that I'm not a Sanskrit scholar. So I had to go talk to someone who actually knew something about Sanskrit. And you know, who do you go to when you want to ask something about one of the most devastating potential things that could ever breach humanity? Do you go to the best known Sanskrit scholar in the world, the best known scientist? No, you go to your friend from college. You go to Siddhartha Rao. I mean, sorry, you go to Surendriya Rao, my friend Sid, who is also occasionally my lawyer. And I consider Sid a warrior poet because time and again, Sid has come to my defense for complicated legal issues. And, you know, like a white knight brandishing a sword or maybe a sacred bow. He has come to my defense legally. And he's also, and I was just at his wedding actually a few weeks ago. Apparently, he somehow convinced his fiancée, now wife, to listen to him read the Bhagavad Gita, actually, maybe the entire Mahabharata, and we'll get into the difference between those two things in a second, to her. Every evening. So without further ado, I want to introduce you to Surendra Rao. You can know him as Sid. Welcome, Sid, to the show.
Thank you so much, Scott, for that wonderful introduction. Surprising and lovely. Perhaps a little more than I deserve, but I'm really happy to be here. Really happy to be on the podcast.
Yeah, no, hell no. You totally deserve it because you are the man. You are, as far as I'm concerned, you are the guy to talk to about dharmic issues in ancient Hinduism and how they relate to our nuclear present. And, you know, so the first thing that I'd like to just ask you from is like the most basic question. Most people listening to this podcast are probably like, the Bhagavad what? What is the Bhagavad Gita? Can you describe to me the context of what is happening here, you know, when we enter into this?
Yeah, so the Bhagavad Gita is one small part of this large epic, this encyclopedic epic, the Mahabharata. And in sort of true Indian storytelling fashion, the Mahabharata has stories inside of stories inside of stories. So there's a frame narrative, but then characters will tell stories inside of that narrative. And sometimes those stories will relate to the narrative itself, like a kind of meta discourse. So they'll talk about something that happened and they'll extensively moralize or philosophize or just generally argue about it. So the Mahabharata is a text that kind of argues with itself constantly through these characters.
And it's like a million pages long, right? It's like,
it's longer than the Odyssey and Iliad combined. And it's really accreted through an oral tradition over, you know, centuries and millennia to become this like encyclopedia corpus. There's like a lot of the epic tradition, like the Homeric epic tradition has these long lists and catalogs, very, very typical of epic poetry because it's so tied with memory and cultural memory. The Mahabharata has tons of lists of things. And the Mahabharata also has the stamp of sort of Brahminical scholastic pedagogy, that the sort of priestly pedagogical obsession with cataloging, listing, you know, categorizing, that's throughout. But there's also this like warrior poem in there, like a Beowulfian poem or you know, an Iliadic poem that is really about warriors. And the Bhagavad Gita is this point in the epic right when the battle is about to start, where it's like the still point in the middle of the storm. So,
and it's between who? Like, who is fighting on so this?
The frame story is these families of cousins that are fighting. But as with all things, the seeds of their conflict goes back many generations. And the reason the Mahabharata, one of the reasons it's so long is that it catalogs the old seeds of the conflict. So by the time you get to the conflict, you've already heard about generations of characters and their foibles. And ultimately, it's a fight over a kingdom, right? It's a land dispute, you could say. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the concrete dispute, is who is going to rule the kingdom. And there are competing claims to the kingdom, which if you step back from the epic, which kind of paints this sort of good guys, bad guys narrative, the claims are not bad on both sides. And I say this as a lawyer where I litigate. The reason people litigate oftentimes is that the claims are ambiguous, right? There's not a clear winner or loser. So you need an arbiter, right? Yeah. But in the Mahabharata, you need a war because the attempts at peace fall apart.
And the crux of the Bhagavad Gita, really, because, I mean, we could go into the whole history of the Mahabharata, but we're not going to. The crux is that this guy, Arjuna, who is really good, he's, you know, wants to be king, right? And he's really good with a bow, right? And yeah. and he's got this guy who's toting him around on a chariot named yes. Krishna.
Yeah.
Tell me about why, you know, I'm not going to ask you to tell me about why. He decides that he's got this problem killing his cousins. And then yeah, Krishna comes in.
What happens I described this as a land dispute with competing claims. So what I didn't get into is one side of that dispute represents a type of philosophy of the world. That's Duryodhana, which literally means dirty fighter, right? But in Sanskrit, it translates better to have highly descriptive names. So Duryodhana is a dirty fighter, and he has tricked his cousins out of their kingdom. And in his view, might makes right. So he's not bad in the sense like he performs the right rituals, he gives gifts to priests, he upholds a kind of social order, but he's bad because he believes that power is the ultimate source of authority, and therefore he can take the kingdom from his cousins because he has the chutzpah to do it, basically. Mm-hmm. Arjuna and his five brothers represent claims that are grounded in what we might call dharma, or in maybe virtue, right? And Arjuna is the middle child of these five Pandavas, who are all demigods. Arjuna is born of Indra, who's like the old Vedic god, right? The greatest, the lord of the Vedic gods. And yes, he is the archer par excellence. And without him, his cousins won't win this war mm-hmm. because they're outnumbered. They have 8 armies. The other side has 11. And yeah, these armies are...
He's basically Achilles, right?
He's Achilles. And the armies are of such epic proportions that if you do the math, it's like... And this is supposedly said in 3000 BC or earlier, millions of soldiers will die in this fratricidal conflict. It is a world-ending war as far as their concept of what the world is. And Arjuna is critical to the battle. And if he defects from the fight, it's gone. Brothers will lose. Now, Arjuna's crisis is that if he doesn't defect from the fight and wins, he's going to slaughter millions of his cousins, his teachers, his grandfather, his people for whom, in his view, the rule of the kingdom is made meaningful. What's mm-hmm. the point in ruling a kingdom if you've slaughtered all your kin? And that's essentially, as he stands on the precipice of battle, this great warrior, he has that crisis where he's like, I can't fight this war because I can't conceive of a righteous war where you kill your own family, you know, and you inherit a kingdom where you've essentially slaughtered the entire male fighting populace of the kingdom, you know?
Which is the same thing that Oppenheimer is dealing with too, right? Because Oppenheimer Correct. Is about to drop the A-bomb and eventually Correct. It's going to turn into the H-bomb. And then it's just,
Correct.
it is the precipice of a global ending war, right? That is going to happen. And, you know, one question that I wanted to know is that really what's happening in the Bhagavad Gita, it's not just Arjuna's crisis of conscience. It's also mm-hmm. Krishna, who is a Hindu god, mm-hmm. the incarnation mm-hmm. of Vishnu, who happened yes. to be his charioteer, who then reveals to Arjuna, I believe, it's mm-hmm. in the Bhagavad Gita, hey, actually, I'm God, guy.
Right, right. I am the ultimate being, the god, right? Right. This is obviously a setup, right? An epic literary setup, because the idea of a human conversing directly with God in their moment of crisis is just already loaded with meaning, right? Mm-hmm. And in the Hindu tradition, this is like iconic, this conversation between Arjuna and Krishna. It's also totally unrealistic because it's happening on the eve of battle and then it goes on for 18 chapters of philosophical discourse, right? So it's a bending of time that happens in the Gita to accommodate but, you know, one way to read it as a contemporary reader is that it's psychological. Mm-hmm. I mean, having gone through the death of my own mother, I can tell you the moment when she died felt not like one moment. It felt like an entire thought and soul turning, conversion of sorts. So mm-hmm. I think in Arjuna's extreme distress, there was a psychological reading of the Gita that this long dialogue, what's called a samvad, which is not a dialogue in the Platonic sense. They're not like arguing in that way, but it's more of a discourse aimed at discovering truth where really one person does a lot of the speaking. That's Krishna. Arjuna sort of peppers him with questions. But it's not this philosophical jousting dialogue like you would read in Plato.
Right.
So to somebody, it's a coming together of speech in the service of truth. And that's what's going on because Arjuna is in crisis and Krishna is his charioteer. And, you know, in the Hindu iconography of this, there's a deep allegory with the mind and the soul and the body, right? The chariot is the body. The mind, you know, the charioteer is the guider of the body, right? Is the mind or the intellect or the buddhi. And we need that charioteer. And so the soul inside, wow, Arjuna is interrogating. There's a lot of symbolism there, yeah, right?
Well, it's fascinating that Krishna is the charioteer, but he's also sort of, right, like the soul in a way, right?
And there are so many parables in the Hindu tradition about the horses and the reins as a metaphor for the senses that have to be controlled and literally reined, which you get a lot of that in the Gita, this idea that the mind in equanimity can sort of transcend this kind of suffering that Arjuna is feeling. And that's a lot of what Krishna talks to him about, right?
Yeah,
this transcendent suffering.
Probably, 20% of the book is talking about yogic principles, about—
Correct. You know,
and we're going to get into those in a second, because that's where this starts getting really interesting. But let's for now at least stick with that one metal quote, right? Let's go to Oppenheimer and his translation. So we're going to do three translations of this, right?
Okay.
The first one is Oppenheimer's translation. And I believe he actually translated his own version of the Gita. As I understand it, he knew Sanskrit and actually translated the whole Gita.
He was a deep classicist, Latin, Greek, and later Sanskrit. He was deep into it.
Yeah, which is amazing. And it's wonderful that the person who invented the bomb also thought deeply about these issues. It wasn't just an automaton. He was like, no.
No, he was a humanist and a scientist, a humanist of sorts. Yeah, a philologist humanist. Yeah.
And so his quote, and I only know that first line, and I think it's like line 720 in the Bhagavad Gita, which is, I am become death, destroyer of worlds, which is metal, as I said. And I think the interesting thing is the become death section. But I also read this other translation, and I actually have a few other lines that came after, which explain a little bit more of the context of that particular passage, which is, and this is from my version, Bhagavad Gita by, with Attilus Huxley as the guy who wrote the intro. And he says, I am come as time, waster of the peoples, ready for that hour that ripens their ruin. All these hosts must die. Strike, stay your hand, no matter. And that's
very poetic translation.
Yeah. This is a very poetic translation.
Yeah.
So what was the translation? And I actually liked your translation that you gave me more. Do you
Let me look it up. I have it somewhere. I might be able to say it from memory.
No, I just texted it to you.
Oh, okay, great. Here, let me pull it up.
So because we live in the modern world, I can telepathically send
you. Yeah, right. We have telepathy.
We are great yogis.
yes, this is a translation I wrote, which is also intended to be poetic. I am time grown old, destroyer of worlds, relentlessly driven to annihilation. Whatever you do or nothing at all these you see arrayed shall fall.
Yeah. Again, the whole passage is actually even more metal, because what he's saying here is that, I like the time aspect of this, right?
Yeah.
When you say, I am time grown old, because how does time grow change, right? Because one thing that he's often saying throughout this whole book is that time doesn't even exist, right? That time is just sort of it is a thing that's out there, but space and time aren't the way we think about it. But, and yet in this case, time has grown old.
From an eternal perspective, imagine you're Krishna, right? And you are outside of time. So you can see time as if it's all one thing. Time is not experienced by you the way it's experienced by us. And in a sense, time is just like an object. It's kind of strange,
Which is what physics is doing at a very tiny level. When we talk about space time,
understand, but the Big Bang is not, this concept of before the Big Bang implies a timeline, but time starts at the Big Bang. Time emerges with space, is kind of my understanding of contemporary physics and how it would be explained. There isn't time before that. So even to say that sentence involves us in some grammatical category mistakes, right?
Totally.
Problem. Yeah.
And then the second half of that, and to use your translation, whatever you do, Arjuna, with your bow, or nothing at all, whether or not you take an action, all of those warriors, gonna die.
Yeah.
Like the death is all but certain. And
it's fated. Yeah.
And instead, and this actually leads into this question of duty, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Krishna is basically saying, look, you have you were born into the body that you have with the parameters that are around you. And everything is essentially written, and every man's fate does end because death is a real mm-hmm. freaking thing. And mm-hmm. and you must act because that is what humans are here for, right? It's to take action and not mm-hmm. be attached to the outcome, which is really hard to do. If you think about it.
Yeah, this is the Nishkama Karma idea that you act without attachment to the outcome. Although I will tell you, Scott, I first got deep into the Gita as a sort of thinking about it at the age of 12 when my parents took me some lectures on the Gita. And then I think that I misunderstood this concept to my detriment. And I'm only now beginning to understand what it means, what is intended by this non-attachment to outcome. It's very complicated, you know. But yeah, I mean, look, part of the problem is Arjuna feels guilt. He feels responsible for what's about to happen. And at a psychological, rhetorical level, Krishna is trying to relieve him of this sense of responsibility by really pointing out how small he is in the face of this cataclysmic event that is happening. It is not in his control to stop the war. And earlier in the text, Krishna tells Arjuna, look, if you choose not to act, it's still a choice and it has consequences. There's no way to be in the world in a vacuum and not affect it. So the renunciate path, the sort of monkish path to like go meditate and live in the mountains has consequences too. You're not going to escape the consequences by bowing out, essentially, is what Krishna is telling him.
Or you're not going to escape consequences.
There will be consequences. Yes, yes. Right. But to your point, they're all going to die anyway. Right. Mm-hmm. And so this idea of guilt, which is very troubling because we, you know, of course, there's a concept of murder. Right. I mean, mm-hmm. just because somebody's going to die doesn't mean I have to be the agent that causes it. And so there's a deeply troubling thing about what is being said. But I'll throw this last thing out. According to the Hindu tradition, the Mahabharata takes place at the end of what we would call an age. There are these ages of creation or human time where we kind of go through a process of degradation. This seems also to have been part of the Greek religion, that the world was created in kind of a more pure golden state, and then we go into the age of silver and then bronze and iron, I think, in the Greek view. We also have these yugas. And the Mahabharata is at this turning point between a heroic age and a degraded age. We're in the fourth. We are now in the Kali Yuga, in the degraded age. And a lot of what happens in this war is the breakdown of warrior code of ethics. You know, not to fight at night, they do that. Not to have a more powerful warrior attack a less powerful warrior. There are sort of gradations of warriors. To attack an unarmed person, to attack a person seeking mercy and sanctuary. All of these are wrong and all of these happen in the battle. To lie and to trick the enemy into putting their weapons down and then kill them.
God, that's so all World War II as well. Like we did all of that
right,
stuff in World
right.
War II.
But the significance of the Kurukshetra war is that there was a sort of knightly samurai Budo code amongst these Kshatriyas that meant that war, while it was bloody and messy, was still conducted with honor. Mm-hmm. And that is utterly broken by the end of this. And the entire era shifts. So to the extent Krishna is talking about things collapsing, he's talking about, I think, more than just everyone will die. He means the entire moral order of the world is on the precipice of collapse. There's literally nothing you can do about it, Arjuna. So your idea that, well, you will abstain from the guilt of this by not fighting is somewhat of a psychological idea. It's certainly not a consequentialist idea. You're not going to change this, right?
No.
So
there's this. So before we actually started recording, I told you that I was going to reference maritime piracy here.
Yeah. I don't know where this is going, but.
And you were like, what are you talking about, Scott? What do you mean piracy?
Yeah.
And so I'm going to bring this up right now because I think it's
interesting. Sure.
And I've been reading this book by David Graeber called Pirate Enlightenment, which is about it's about pirate kingdoms in Madagascar. And it's a fine book. But there was one passage that like riveted me. And I listened to it on Audible. So I had to like write it down. So this is like sort of a paraphrase of it. And Here's what I wrote down. Typically, pirate crews were born in mutiny. The law on land was unforgiving. They would be all executed. And the mutinous crew, in committing mutiny, would declare war on the entire world. The flag that they rose would have the skull and crossbones, typical of what we think of as the pirate flag, but would also often feature an hourglass. And this wasn't a threat, right? So this that you are going to die, right? The skull and crossbones wasn't you are going to die. It was an acknowledgement that we are going to die. We, the pirates, are going to die. And it was only a matter of time. And a crew making out that flag on the horizon would find it all the more terrifying to see this announcement that the people coming from them have already accepted that they're going to hell.
Right. So what can you do to them? They've essentially accepted their own death. You can't threaten them by taking their lives away.
That's scary, right? These are warriors who are like, we're going for it. And you're like, oh my God, they already know they're doomed. Right. And in a way there's a relationship here because Arjuna, who's a warrior who has to face his own death as well.
Yeah.
And one of the many things that's going on in this quote where Krishna is saying to him, I am the destroyer of worlds and all of you are dead anyway. It really just says at the end of the day, you're going to do what you do best, acknowledging that your death is there. Now, I'm not calling these pirates enlightened, I mean, but it's an interesting similarity. It's this fatalism that exists in these texts.
Yeah. So there's a problem here, though, because we have the problem of agency, right? Because we're talking about action. What do you do? That's like the fundamental question of the Gita is you have all this philosophy, but you have to translate to like a choice. But if there's no agency, then what's the meaning of the choice, right? So I don't know. I mean, but yes, accepting your own death allows you to be somewhat reckless in your risk taking, right? In a way that maybe you can't be if you're trying to preserve what is already gone, right? Look, Arjuna's crisis is, and I think I told you this, at least is my reading of it, is rooted in the desire to maintain a social order. And there's a really telling passage, I think it's book 2 of the Gita, after Arjuna has basically laid out his case to Krishna about why he shouldn't fight. Krishna kind of laughs. That's what I think the text actually says. He laughs at him and then he accuses Arjuna of using wisdom words, like sophistry, basically. I always thought it was very significant, this laughing thing, because my interpretation of this entire exchange is that what Arjuna doesn't realize is world is already gone. This world he's trying to save. It was gone a while ago. I talked about my mom earlier. She passed from cancer, but when we actually knew that she had cancer, it was a done deal, right? Because the cancer had spread. And then, you know, there's so many stories like this where you discover after the fact that the thing is gone, right? And so I think Krishna is laughing not because he thinks it's funny that they're all going to die, but because he thinks it's funny that Arjuna is clinging to something that is not even there. It's like an illusion, right? It's an idea in his head, but it's not there.
Which leads us back to what you were saying earlier. And I want to dig in a little bit deeper into that, which is, you know, one of the things that Krishna is talking about is like sort of the true nature of reality and like reaching called like enlightenment. And I've talked about enlightenment on this podcast a bunch of times. Like I have this podcast about the monk who fucked everything, which is really about how the concept of enlightenment is actually incredibly dangerous in some ways. But before we go there, let's like really talk about what it is in this case. And I think what Krishna boils it down to is essentially you do your work, you do your duty, and it's but you don't have any anxiety or attachment to the outcome. How does a person do that? Right? Like, what does that mean? What does it mean doing your duty without caring about what happens?
So it's a really good question. So here's the fundamental problem, right? Is that action is always intentional. I mean, let's take Arjuna's situation. He's an archer. If he doesn't point his arrow in the right direction, he can shoot as many arrows as he wants, but he will not actually harm the enemy, right? And to fight is to intentionally aim the arrow at the enemy. So this idea that the outcome is somehow irrelevant or not relevant to the action just doesn't, it's logically incoherent, right? Obviously, Arjuna is literally aiming at a target, right? Mm-hmm. He is aiming to accomplish a target. I think that a couple things are going on with this enlightenment idea. First of all, Krishna presents several different pathways to this enlightenment, but all of them involve some form of sacrifice of an idea or sublimation of a personal agenda towards some larger thing. I think if you're really textual about it, there's this phrase, the phala, the karma phala, the fruit of the action, mm-hmm. which is, it's often translated fruit of the action. I think what you have to understand is that the worldview at the time obviously recognized immediate consequences, but they recognized through karmic operations these much more remote consequences that could mm-hmm. even happen in a next life, right? And there was a belief that every action has a consequence. And if mm-hmm. we don't see it, it just means that it's the seed has been planted and the outcome will come much later, the fruit. Mm-hmm. So when Krishna is saying, don't be attached to the fruit of the action, I think what he's trying to say is don't be attached to your idea of remote outcomes. Like Arjuna's entire crisis is, if I fight this war, this will happen and this will happen and this will happen. And, you know, all of the society will be destroyed. And what Krishna is trying to tell him is, that's not for you to figure out. Those things happen through much larger,
right,
fated circumstantial forces, the sort of ebb and flow of history and time. Your part as an archer is to fight this battle. So yes, aim your arrow at the target, but don't worry about whether a generation from now this will be have some consequence, a fruit, right? Don't worry about the fruit. And the logic he gives him is a sacrificial logic, that the fruit is really essentially for God or for Krishna, or you could mm-hmm. analogize it to what I said. It's not in your control. It is essentially, he's removing from Arjuna the feeling of responsibility due to agency by telling him, you actually don't have control over this, right? Mm-hmm. So why are you taking on this burden? Give it up. Let it go.
Yeah,
but he uses this language of sacrifice, right? Sacrifice, do the action, but the outcome is for Krishna, for God, or however you want to analogize it. But the outcome is not for you, so don't get attached. But it's the fruit. It's not the immediate outcome. That's the distinction I think is very important that personally I misunderstood for the longest time.
It's interesting because, you know, obviously the way the Mahabharata works, right, there's a sort of an initial instigating incident at the very beginning. And we get to the war many, many books later. And, you know, there's another, and this is a nature of all sagas. Like there's this other book called Njal's Saga, which is an Icelandic book, which mm-hmm. it starts with like some sheep grazing on the wrong side of someone's property and ends with like the total destruction of the legal moral order of Iceland. And you know, it started with the sheep. So like, the sheep didn't plan that. Like the sheep wasn't thinking, what am I doing? It's sort of these things pile on top of each other. But at the same time, to go against, you know, to like talk about what Oppenheimer is doing and what Krishna is doing. Yeah, there's all these forces going on there. I mean, maybe it's the same thing. Maybe it's the same distinction between the great man theory of history and the trends and forces theories of history, right?
Correct.
Which is the great man theory of history is like great men do things and their actions drag
history along with them,
right? Whereas trends and forces is all like, well, these things were emerging and like all these power structures were there. And both are talk about basically determinism. And so Krishna in this case is basically laying the case for the trends and forces a theory of history.
I think it's a fairly deterministic text in a way, which results in this paradox because, again, the Gita is fundamental about what do you do, implying some importance to agency. I mean, one way to resolve the paradox, in my view, is to actually take this text not as Krishna persuading Arjuna to fight, but to assume that as a warrior and being who he is Arjuna, he was going to fight anyway. All this talk about I'm going to go live in the woods and not incur this sin and I'll just beg for my food and I don't need the kingdom. It's all talk because at the end of the day, Arjuna is a warrior. He would never be able to face the shame of his peers if he didn't fight. Mm-hmm. So instead, the Gita is like a palliative for somebody who has resigned themselves to war, even if they don't realize it. The Gita helps him to get through it. It's not actually, I mean, this is my reading of it. It's not actually a persuasion text, although it presents that way. Mm-hmm. Because if you believe the theory that Krishna propounds, which is that everyone is just made up of these sort of threads of nature, these three gunas, which kind of give us a imprint, a cast on us, a pattern that just unfolds over time because it has to unfold that way, then the point of persuading somebody to do anything is kind of, it's a moot point, right? You're not going to persuade them. Mm-hmm. They're going to do it because they're going to do it. But Krishna sort of proposes this like highly intentional theory of morality where it's sort of matters less what you do and more how or why you do, you know, what you think and feel as you do.
Mm. So it's sure, all the intentions that matter.
Yeah. See, Arjuna is about to kill his cousins, which is terrible, right? Under any conventional view of morality. And certainly the view that prevailed at that time, as far as we can tell. Mm-hmm. But then if he does it for a jealous or a personal reason, like I want the kingdom, so I'm going to kill my cousin, he incurs some karmic sin, some problem.
And this goes into the cosmology of Hinduism, which implies, you know, returning of the soul, right? You know,
right. But he does it purely as a sense of dharma, as duty, right? Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with him wanting the kingdom. If he can somehow remove all desire out of this and say, look, there's a bigger principle here. The kingdom is ours by right. And if we allow our cousins to take it under this sort of might makes right theory, we actually harm the world in a much larger sense because we establish this precedent that powerful people can just take and weaker people give. That's not good. So therefore, on principle, we fight, win or lose, live or die, kingdom or no kingdom. I think that's what the deeper, that's my explanation of how to resolve this seeming paradox between agency and persuasion. That's the only thing I can come up with. Anyway, yeah. But
well, it's interesting because Krishna also says in that line that you could not fight. Whether or not you do it, If the other side, if your cousins win and power wins out, the age is still going to end, right?
And it's still going to end, and they're still going to die eventually. And again, it's I think it's meant to be provocative and disturbing. If you're not a little bit disturbed by it, you're kind of missing a large part of the text. It is provocative.
Yeah.
I think it's often treated by certainly by contemporary Hindus as a kind of Bible substitute, like you can quote chapter and verse, and it's sort of a practical guide to life. And people often talk about this is a sort of analogy for all of us speaking to God, searching through our problems. But I think that decontextualizes it too much, and it somewhat defangs the horror of what the Gita is situated in a horrific situation,
yeah,
a horrific context. It's not like me deciding whether to take an umbrella if it's raining outside. You know, this is a very different sort of choice. And I think there's validity to taking this analogic interpretation. Say, Arjuna is like all human beings searching for meaning. Krishna is God, and all of us talk to God. And Arjuna talking to Krishna is just like me talking to God. There's some value in that, obviously, and there's some truth to that, but the literal interpretation, I think, is sometimes lost, and the context is very, very important in the Gita.
Yeah.
It's still part of a narrative, and Arjuna is still a specific character in that narrative, and Krishna is talking to Arjuna using a language that you would use to a warrior the whole first chapter we talked about this is Krishna basically saying, like, be a man, don't be a sissy, you know, like, like people are going to mock you, you know, that's rhetorical, that's not logical, and that is right. For a warrior, from warrior to warrior, it's absolutely makes sense as a sort of rhetorical strategy.
The other thing that, you know, when you talk about like intentions, and I think I want to move into this section of this discussion is where, you know, they're really, it's a yogic text as well,
right?
It's really, you know, there's duty, but it's also how you perform your duty. And there are a lot of words that we may have to define very briefly, Atman, Brahman, Prakriti, and Gunas, and Purusha. You know, these are interesting words that we need to define, but essentially it comes down to the way you hold yourself in moments. Like, you know, you're like, you just have this sort of like, you're equanimous, you're okay with whatever happens around you. Yeah. And to quote a passage, this is from my translation, and he's talking about like serenity. And it's like the serene one absorbed in the Atman. And Atman, I think we can just define as like, you could say the Godhead, but like sort of the essence of the universe, like the oneness, maybe. How would you define Atman?
Maybe. I'll give a quibble to that later, but yes, keep going. No one interrupting.
I mean, it takes, you know, Krishna the whole book to describe Atman. Let's just All right. So the serene one absorbed in the Atman masters his will. He knows no disquiet in heat nor in cold, pain or pleasure, in honor or dishonor. So basically, right. You're like, no matter what the world is throwing at me, I am steady.
Right, right. This is sort of like that famous Rudyard Kipling poem, If, you know.
I don't know that one.
If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, you know, he keeps going. He talks about if you can make one heap of all your winnings and risk it on one turn of pitch and toss, you know, basically this kind of serenity, right? Mm-hmm. I forget the line that I was thinking of. Oh, yeah. If you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two imposters just the same. So it's very much in the similar spirit. And Kipling's If is seen often as like a kind of masculine anthem to stoicism. And like,
yeah, this feels very stoic to me, right? Because they're even talking about hot and cold, which of course, anyone who follows me understands that I have a thing about hot and cold. Yeah. But like, you get into the world is pushing on your nervous system. And,
correct.
And you're, you know, pain or pleasure, whether you're not having sex or you're getting beaten up by your cousins or honor or dishonor, the social fabric, in all of that, you have your duty and you act the way you must act at all times.
Okay. So I have kind of three framings for this, if you'll indulge
me. Great. No, please, please.
Okay. So there is this kind of universal framing. We should all aspire to this. You know, this is what I was talking about with the decontextualizing of the Gita and applying it as a universal text. And anybody can follow a yogic path and anybody can train themselves, as you know and have written about, to cold tolerance and to pain tolerance to a certain degree. And we can learn essentially through a type of mind-body practice, an integrated practice, how to do that, right? And I think absolutely Krishna is talking about that. The other thing, though, that I think is deeply rooted in the Gita is this anxiety that arises out of heterodox religious movements like Jainism and Buddhism. Mm. So, you know, Buddha, as the story goes, he was a prince, and he sees these things that disturb him. He sees a dying person. He sees suffering in the world. He's been shielded from that largely by his parents, the suffering kind of leaks into his life. And then one of the things he sees is an ascetic meditating calmly. And he immediately decides he wants to do that, right? He wants to be that ascetic meditating calmly because it's the only way he knows to deal with a world where people die and everything seems to be infused with pain, right? And that is somewhat destabilizing to society, because if everybody goes off and does the ascetic thing, right, with the begging bowl and seeking alms, who is a householder? Who pays taxes? Who has children? Who raises armies? Who makes art? Who does anything, right? Mm-hmm. And so, and there was a problem, and, you know, Buddhism was a very proselytizing religion in India. And so there was this need in sort of Hindu response in their theorizing about duty and the good life to address this,
well,
right?
Doesn't
and
the Gita predate Buddha?
It does, but I think that so the cortex does, but there's no way to know what was added when, right? Mm. There's a crystallized text, but and I'm not suggesting that this is a post-Buddhist thing. What I'm suggesting is that we as readers coming to this as Hindu readers over millennia are incorporating these types of ideas in our interpretation of the Gita, right? Mm. That there's this problem, like it's very traditional in Hindu wedding for the bride's parents to say this Sanskrit phrase to the groom, which essentially is don't go to Kashi. Don't abandon your wife. Why? Buddha abandons his wife to seek enlightenment. So don't go to Kashi is like, Kashi is where you go to die to achieve moksha. But they want the guy to stick around, you know? Don't chase enlightenment yet. It's like St. Augustine who says, Lord, give me chastity, but not yet. You know, it's that thing. It's like, okay, but not yet. Right?
You just reminded me. So the listeners who are not familiar with my own personal history, I was married once and I got married in a Hindu wedding. And there's actually a whole part of the Hindu wedding, which is, you don't go to Kashi, where you grab like an umbrella and you put on some sandals and you hold a copy of the Bhagavad Gita.
So you're about to leave, yeah.
And you pretend to walk out of the wedding hall. And then the bridegroom, the bride's father comes in and
has to persuade you.
Oh no, come sample the fruits of my daughter. It's going to be
great. It's all
great.
Theater. Yeah. But it's because, and I don't mean it's because Buddha did this. Buddha did this because it's a path, right? Within Hinduism, there's always this tension between the renunciant path and the active sort of in the life path. And the Gita embodies that dialectic through the whole thing. This whole thing about Samkhya and yoga is about contemplation versus action. That's really the best way I can do it. So I'm not saying it's a post-Buddhist thing, just to be very clear. What I'm saying is that Buddha sort of like is the most extreme example of this problem in this type of religious milieu, this escapist or monkish path, which was destabilizing.
It's funny when you talk about Buddhism, and you know people on this channel know that I talk about Buddhism a lot.
Buddha does
say it is the middle way, but it, you know,
ultimately he abandons extreme asceticism for the middle way. But Buddhism, for the first time, created this monastic community, which there were mathas and there were temple communities. But I think this idea of a wandering monastic community that survived on begging, that was, from what I understand, at least somewhat new. But I said there were three things. And the third thing is, again, Arjuna, we have to root the text in Arjuna. He's a specific person with a specific set of problems. He's highly disturbed by what he's about to do, right? It is disturbing. And this whole thing about yoga, Krishna I think there's a rhetorical core of this. And this is a very good move that Krishna makes. He actually paints a picture for Arjuna of the meditating person. He doesn't just talk about yoga. He talks about the person. And if you look at Arjuna's questions, Arjuna frequently says, well, what is this person like? How does he eat? How does he sleep? What does he do? Because Krishna understands the power of the image of the meditating person in the midst of chaos. Very powerful image, especially to somebody in psychological distress. It's rhetorical, right? And what Krishna is doing is painting. He's not giving him a set of prescriptions. There are parts that talk about meditation and how to meditate, but on the whole, he's painting an image. Mm-hmm. And the Gita is full of these images. The turtle withdrawing its limbs into the shell is like the person withdrawing their senses from the world. The steady candle, you know, as opposed to the candle that like flickers, the candle that the flame is steady, is like the one-pointed mind. It's full of imagery, right? It's like a poetic philosophy. It's not a purely logical philosophy. It's a rhetorical and poetic philosophy. And this is my quibble with people who universalize too quickly. I really think it's good to think about Arjuna as a specific individual in a context. I think that opens up a lot of richer meaning in the Gita than just saying this is how we should all be, you know?
Yeah. When you read the Gita, I will say that there's a lot of these are some of my criticisms of it in a way. It's like, you know, Krishna really tells you what you need to do over and over again. And it's actually sort of intense. It's like, you have to listen to me no matter what. And every single one of your actions must be dedicated to the Atman and the Brahman and like, and everything. Seems like, you know, a lot of work, like really hard. Like you have to be concentrated on this at all times.
Yeah. And Arjuna, one of his questions, I forget which book it is. He basically says, hey, Krishna, how do you actually do this? The mind is always moving. Like, how do you control it? And Krishna admits that it's extremely difficult, right? It's extremely difficult. I mean, look, a couple of things to say there. One is there's this whole question about enlightenment as a category in Hindu discourse, right? Mm-hmm. Is it something like, are we all just enlightened and wander around in a kind of illusion? This is Shankaracharya's Advaitin model, right? That it's sort of like you can't see anything, but the glasses are just sitting on your head and all you have to do is like push them down. Mm-hmm. You're looking for your glasses, but they've just been there all the time, right? And so enlightenment isn't really like a state you achieve. It's, or, you know, another analogy, there's treasure buried underneath you. It's there. Mm-hmm. You just have to dig it up. But it's never not there, right? It's not like a state change in that sense. It is a state change, but it's not it's a latent thing that is always. I think that's my understanding of sort of Advaita's doctrine. But then you get like Ramanuja and Madhva, and they have very different theories of this Atman, this self principle, universal principle, Atman Brahman relationship.
Oh yeah, so you said you were going to define Atman for us.
Yeah, so I mean, look, you can't define Atman, but the best a way to think through this, I feel, as a Sanskrit dilettante, not a scholar. And I should show my cards. I am from the Madhvist tradition by birth. So we actually...
Oh, a Madhvist. Oh, come on. Oh, wait.
Madhva is a tattvavada, like a realist. He believes in empirical reality of things, and he doesn't really go in for this. It's all an illusion. It's all maya. He thinks the world is real. He thinks empiricism is valid. He also thinks there is he famously holds up two fingers to signify difference. Mm. Distinction is the most important sort of thread of Madhva's thought, which is very Aristotelian. So this Atman and this Brahman, in the Advaitin idea, they're actually pretty much identical. And Brahman is like a universal, and Atman is often translated as the self with a capital S. But the sort of core of the Advaitist idea is that it is like finding your glasses or finding the treasure. When you find it, you realize that there's an identity between Atman and Brahman. Yeah. And in Madhva's theology, there's a difference between Atman and Brahman. But so let me just quickly get into that. There's this search for the grounding of things in a lot of Hindu philosophy. So, and by that, I mean, if you imagine a cloth that's dyed red or dyed blue, like the blue and the red are qualities that are imposed on the cotton cloth that is sort of substratum, mm-hmm. right? So you could think of this substratum, superstratum. And, you know, in certain theories of grammar, like om is considered a kind of substratum of sound, and then all other sounds layer on top of it. This concept comes up a lot. And the same with this investigation of the self, right? So in the Upanishad, the corpus, you see all of this investigation of what is this self? Because we walk around, we eat, we talk, we live, and experience reality as if we are a self that does things or is doing something or having some coherent experience. But what is the self, right?
Right.
And what is the self that witnesses us doing, and what is the self that does? And so, you know, early on, there are these kind of rudimentary and I think deliberately wrong answers given, like, oh, it's food or it's water or it's something else, right? But after a while, there's this idea that there is a self underneath all the transformations that we experience.
This might can't be, have it. This might yeah, be what they call the purusa, right? Which is
yeah, the purusa is a laden concept, but it is something like, yeah, or sakshi in Madhva's theology. There's a witness. Because you can't have transformation without a stable substratum.
Right.
If it's all change, then it's also not change, because right. you need to measure change against the stable, right? So what's the stable thing?
And to describe, just because some listeners may not understand what I mean by witness, is like when you're meditating, you sit there yeah. and then you have all these thoughts go through your head, like, what is Sid talking about? I don't know about yeah. Bhagavad Gita, whatever. And there's those words that come up, but there's also a part of yourself that can witness that you're having those words in your mind.
Correct,
right?
Correct. And, so when you meditate, you immediately experience this sort of split mind thing where you're able to both have thoughts and witness yourself having thoughts. Mm-hmm. This was seen as very significant to the Upanishadic like sort of method of inquiry into the self. Also, the fact that when we're in deep sleep, they talk a lot about sleep. We can have dreams.
Mm-hmm.
We can also have dreamless sleep where we have some kind of awareness of being a self, but it's like it seemed to them that that must be the core substrate, whatever was going on there. Because as you peel off layers of change and experience, whatever's left is what's there. And so that witness, they decided in some type of insight, I don't think this is a purely, I think this is an experienced thing. It's not a purely logical thing, that this witness was somehow an eternal, unchangeable and sort of numinous thing, like the soul, but it's really not this Western or Judeo-Christian Islamic concept.
And it's interesting because you certainly can experience it while you meditate. Like you can even do it now, because when you're listening to me and you're also thinking, what is Scott thinking? Like, you know, that's you witnessing your own thoughts.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know how much time you have today. So I did want to move through a couple other
things. Yeah, let's keep going.
Because, you know,
I want to say one more thing. Atman is embodied, and the Gita uses this word dehi a lot for the embodied soul. And Brahman is not. Brahman is like the universe soul or whatever you want to call it. So in the Madhva's theology, they're considered to be sort of eternally distinct. And in the Shankaracharya theology, they can merge, right?
Interesting.
Atman and the Brahman merge when you have this realization that they're really so fundamentally the same.
That's interesting, because I struggle, you know, it seems to be synonyms sometimes in the translations that I'm reading.
Yes.
So, you know, another thing I wanted to point out, you know, you said that the Madhvas are the empiricists. And, you know, at the end of the Gita, Krishna starts talking about what a good person is and what a bad person is. And
who has
demonic nature and who has like a godly nature, divine nature, I guess. And, you know, we're not going to get into all of the terms that I had that I had offered mm-hmm. earlier, which was like the Gunas, which is a whole mm-hmm. thing. But the bad Guna is Tamas, right? Which is yeah. like the greed yeah. Guna, which is yeah. like the nature of greed. And mm-hmm. for those of you who want to go deep into that, go down a different rabbit hole, because I'm not going into there now. But I did want to point out one of the things in the demonic nature seems yeah. to me actually a bit contradictory to the way I think I'm a demon. Or let me just put it this way. I think I'm a demon when I read yeah, this. And here's yeah. why. It says, men of demonic nature know neither what they ought to do nor what they should refrain from doing. There is no truth in them or purity or right conduct. They maintain that the scriptures are a lie and that the universe is not based upon moral law, but godless, mm-hmm. conceived in lust, created by copulation without any mm-hmm. other cause, i.e. evolution, right? Mm-hmm. Because they believe in this darkness of their little minds, these degraded creatures do horrible deeds, attempting to destroy the world, like Oppenheimer. They are enemies of mankind. And I'm like, I read that passage. I was like, oh, dude does not like science.
Do you know the book and the verse?
No, I can tell you the book. It's in 16, Divine and Demonic really Tendencies.
Good, interesting.
And I was reading that passage and I was like, oh my, well, like, you know, one, I don't think I'm a bad person, but I don't know what's always right and wrong and what I should refrain from doing. And, you know, he's a little mean because he calls them degraded creatures and like darkness in little minds. Sure. But, you know, the idea that copulation is actually a fundamental force in reality, I was like, well, that's really what Darwin was talking about.
Well, and there are passages that go back to the Vedas that suggest the universe is born out of some kind of desire, right? So... Mm-hmm. Kama actually is the word for desire, like the Kama Sutra, but Kama is much larger and, you know, can encompass even monks meditating in generating tapas. They generate heat from their austerities, mm-hmm. but that heat is like a kind of spiritual desire, you know? Look, I would say this, cause we started with Dharma, and this is actually like a very good link into Dharma. Dharma is one of the most complex concepts. And in Hinduism, there's an entire literature, the Dharma Shastras, that try to explain what is crudely translated as duties. But one of the things that's argued in the tradition is that we can't understand Dharma from empirical sensory evidence. We can't, because Dharma is supersensory. It's suprasensory. It's a transcendent concept. So you can't know it like, you know, feeling that fire is hot or that a stone is heavy, right? You're not just going to get it that way. So if you want to learn about Dharma, according to this line of argument, you need some other source of evidence. Could it be logic? Could it be testimony of others? You know, and the problem with logic is that it's fundamentally grounded in human experience to a large degree. And according to this argument, that's not enough. The problem with testimony is the person giving the testimony could be a flawed person. They might be mistaken. They might even be evil, right? You don't know. They could be lying to you, right? So the consensus was you need some sort of revealed corpus to actually tell you what is Dharma and what is not Dharma. Now you could respond, well, I don't care, right? Like who needs to, what if I just don't want to know about Dharma, right? Mm-hmm. But at least in the Hindu conception, Dharma is tied to a kind of order and stability in the world. And they are somewhat pessimistic. Without Dharma, like, there will be chaos. They call it the fish-fish problem. The large fish eats the small fish. There's rapaciousness. There's no kind of like, it's a Hobbesian like nightmare, right? It's not pretty for society or for people. And ultimately it leads to bad outcomes, right? Collapse of society, destruction of wealth and any higher purpose in life. So it was sort of implicitly accepted that we want and need some form of Dharma, but then the only way to it is through a real corpus, which then leads, of course, in a very convenient way to the Vedic corpus, which Hindus mm-hmm. believe has no human author, right? Yeah. So
it becomes it sort of points you down a road, if you take it in a certain way, towards fundamentalism. Yeah. It's like, trust me, bro, this is the word of God.
You essentially have to say, well, I don't believe the Vedas or without a human author. But then you're kind of caught on the horns of a dilemma, because you still have to respond to this argument that we can't know about Dharma from everyday experience. I think that's where I think the argument is flawed. I think we can know about Dharma from everyday experience. And I would just throw out this, and from logic, I throw out this example from Plato's Republic. He talks about a band of thieves, and he and Socrates is trying to explain why it's better to have justice than injustice, and why justice is superior to injustice. And he's responding to the argument that everyone wants to break the law and just kind of copulate and do whatever they want. And the only reason we obey laws is out of fear. So clearly injustice is better if we all want it, you know? Mm-hmm. And so Socrates says, okay, well, imagine a band of thieves that has no justice whatsoever between themselves. They can't even make contracts between themselves. They can't even coordinate their efforts because each one is trying to stab the other one in the back at all times. They're not going to be very good thieves, right? Mm-hmm. In order to be good thieves, even though they're committing some form of injustice, they have to have justice amongst themselves, right?
They need to be good pirates is what we're going back to pirates.
He makes this argument that essentially justice, even in the most unjust setting, is the winning thing, right? It's what allows them to be thieves. And I think in a similar way, dharma is kind of essential and can be logically derived as, you know, what conditions need to obtain for things not to fall apart, in the Yeatsian phrase, right? Things fall apart. That's why these ideas of non-stealing, and I mean, if in a world where theft is not at least somewhat regulated, you know, it's kind of hard to see how anything will happen, right? So I think you can get to dharma without it, but certainly the tradition would say, no, you need suprasensory evidence, and that only comes from the Vedas as far as we know, because all other texts that we know do have human authors, but these, you know, we don't know of any human author. Now, you and I know that we don't think that's very persuasive. We think there were human authors. They were just so ancient that we can't.
Yeah, and there were probably many authors. Like, as you said, like, the Mahabharata was probably added to. Just written by a guy named Valmiki.
But you know, I understand the need for the faithful to have these ideas. I mean, an Orthodox Jewish person believes that the Torah was revealed, not of human authorship. There's a really famous scholar of the human origins of the Torah who, as an academic, writes about human origins, but as a believing Orthodox Jew says, I believe this was revealed. Mm-hmm. So what do you say to that? You know, right. I mean, I don't want to offend anybody who thinks these things are revealed, because it's not that relevant to me. I think at the end of the day, I go back to the Gita's core thing, which is what do you do? And whether or not you think the Vedas are just totally revealed, or maybe just as good a starting point as any, which is what I think, you know, so, it sort of comes back to the same question. What do you do? Right. I mean, you just have to figure out what to do.
So building off of that, and let's bring this full circle. When Oppenheimer said, I am become death, destroyer of worlds. What do you think? Why did he choose this phrase? What was he thinking?
I think, like Arjuna, he was extremely psychologically distressed by the forces he, in some reading of this, was unleashing on the world. And the Gita is a text that reassures by telling you, you are not the causal mechanism. You are not unleashing on the world a great force. So if you are Oppenheimer, you've been asked by the United States government to fundamentally contribute to a world-destroying weapon, I could see why I'd be very comfortable to take refuge in the Gita, because your other option is to say no, but to take the Gita's argument probably would have been built anyway, right? I mean, they would have found somebody else. Maybe it would have taken longer. Maybe it would have been slightly different, but they were going to build an atomic bomb, right? And so this is like Arjuna's problem. They're going to die anyway. The war is going to happen. You know, what are you going to do? I think it's comforting for Oppenheimer. And I haven't seen the movie, which I really need to, but from what I've read about that time in his life, he was deeply engaged with the Bhagavad Gita as a text in that time. And it probably got him through the whole thing without having a mental breakdown. It's my answer to the question.
Well, I want to say thank you so much for coming on the show. Surendra Rao is also a poet, and you can find his poetry. Where can they find your poetry?
Did
you just swear?
I swore on your religious podcast, Scott. I don't know what to do. Shiningdarkly.com, I think, has some of my poetry. I'll have to put more up there.
Okay. And he's also on Instagram, and we also have a very interesting history, which we can talk about at some other point.
A different podcast episode for that. So maybe talking not dharma.
yeah. We had some very non-dharmic things we did in our past. So, you know, for everyone who was listening, thank you so much for tuning in to Scott Carney Investigates at Pokey Bear LLC in Denver, Colorado. You know, go check out other episodes. For instance, the Muck Who Fucked Everything is still one of my favorite episodes. You may also like one about the history of Santa Anna and why he was the real hero of the Alamo. Texans are not allowed.
As a Texan, I don't know if I can unsubscribe to that.
Unsubscribe, guys. Unsubscribe. all right. You know, if you're really liking the show, check out my Patreon too, because I've got good stuff in the pipeline. And say hello to your dog. Bye, everyone.
Sorry about that.